Park Place Meeting, Thursday morning, 17th June 1976. The ancient wisdom spread in two great branches. One was the original Veda, eastwards of Iran. The other was the Kabbalah, westwards from Iran. The two branches carried the same wisdom, expressed in different ways to suit the people, and also to emphasize two main aspects of the one truth. The Kabbalah tended to emphasize the aspect of power and of universal creation through that original creative energy. The Veda also talked of creation, but more in terms of human understanding and human psychology. Both branches presented their own wonderful, profound, and magnificent conceptions of the self. The self in its supreme expression, which comes under the word God or whatever other word you like, and the self as man. In course of time, when this knowledge seeped through to a larger and larger number of people, the self as God was the paradigm, the blueprint, if you like, for understanding the self as man. Let us try and glance, however briefly, the presentation of the Kabbalah. There is a word which is used in the Kabbalistic writings, which is Sephiroth. Sephiroth is the plural of Sephira. And Sephiroth simply means numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on. Now these numbers were symbolized the profoundest metaphysical concepts that the Semitic people were capable of. They regarded the whole universal process, the process of creation, as an activity of biologically structured energies. Biologically, not in the restricted sense of the word biology, when we refer to the living physical organism, but from bios life pertaining to life in its entirety, in its fullness, including the life of the unknown, the life of the Supreme. From Brahman right down to man, as the Indians would say. Now this system of the Kabbalah is a very ancient one, as ancient as that of the original Veda. It antedates the days of Abraham. And as far as we know, Abraham took the Kabbalah with him westwards from Iran. They say he came from Ur, the city of Ur of the Chaldees. And he took it westwards because he saw that those around him who held this knowledge were degenerating and misusing it as magicians. So the call came to him to go westwards, away from his original city. This call, of course, is expressed always in personalistic terms in all the Semitic faiths. God called him. He obeyed the call and took the Kabbalah with him. In course of time, it got lost. The word Kabbalah literally means tradition. The tradition. The oral teaching handed down from master to disciple. This was the Kabbalah. In course of time, it got lost. Then somehow, it re-emerged. And after it re-emerged, it began to find expression in writing from about the 2nd century onwards, the 2nd century of the Christian era onwards. That means something like 22 centuries had passed by since Abraham moved westwards. And the writings which we have, which constitute the Kabbalah, are very difficult to interpret and to understand. Extremely difficult. But there is a key, at least one important key, to unlock the mysteries. And that is to know the significance, the deep metaphysical significances attached to the numbers as such. The Old Testament, the Torah particularly, the books of Moses as they are called, they were not written by Moses as we have them, they were written afterwards. The books of Moses, the Torah, exist in a linguistic form which is extraordinarily put together, especially with respect to the first few chapters of Genesis. The first five or six chapters particularly. But the whole of the Torah is built up in this manner. Every single word of the Hebrew language used there consists of so many letters. Each letter is associated with a number. And if you have the key to the system of the numbers and what the numbers represent, then each single word conveys all that deep metaphysical teaching associated with the word. You see what an extraordinarily complex creation this is. Very, very difficult to unravel. The difficulty is enhanced by the fact that every single letter of the Hebrew alphabet is a sound which is also built up of other letters. If, for example, you take the letter Dalit, it's got the D sound in it, the L sound in it, and the TH sound in it. Each of these is a letter of the alphabet. So you've got a very, very complex fusion of so many deep concepts involved in the Torah as such. Now, this is not exclusive to the Old Testament, particularly to the Torah, the books of Moses. This science of numbers was also utilized in just the same sort of way in India. The secret was never given out. It was partly given out in the Kabbalah. But it was never given out fully. It has never been really properly written down in any of the Indian writings. But there are hints. In the Chandogya Upanishad, when Narada goes to Sanat Kumara to be taught, and Sanat Kumara asks him, "Tell me what you already know," he gives the big list of what he already knows. And in that list is one word, Rashim, which is translated as mathematics. Of course, scholars, not knowing about this secret code, just gave the literal translation, mathematics. And everybody thinks, oh well, they knew a little bit about arithmetic and that sort of thing. That Narada was proficient in numbers, in that sense. The proficiency actually was contained in his knowledge of the significance of those numbers. It remained a hidden tradition. This is one of the great difficulties in understanding the old writings. To come back to the Kabbalah as such, these numbers, the Sephiroth as they are called, in course of time began to have another meaning. They stood with the development of mystical terminology for they came to signify the emergence of what are known as the divine powers or emanations out of the original primordial reality. So this Kabbalah is the gnosis, the knowledge, which concerns the evolution, so to say, of God by a system of emanation which has this peculiarity, that the emanation is not different from the original source of creation. In all, there are 10 emanations. But God Himself is each and every one of these emanations. They in their togetherness are God, and each one is God. To the logical intellect, of course, this begins to sound like a farrago of unintelligible stuff. But to the consciousness which has become, to some extent at least, freed of the limitations of separateness and of thinking and perceiving in terms of finite particulars in space and time, this kind of paradoxical presentation becomes meaningful. So these emanations, which have been given names, of course, are the divine attributes of God. The innermost being of divinity is called Ein Sof. Ein Sof, the infinite. And this infinite has neither qualities nor attributes. Ein Sof is the unknown and the unknowable, the innermost, the hidden being of God, which remains forever dark, dark in the sense of hidden and unknown, unknowable. When we can only use very poor human language for this, God decides to embark upon the activity of creation, out of that, as the emanations proceed, they make visible the hidden dark. So it is as if there were two worlds. We can talk in terms of two worlds purely for the sake of trying to understand with our brains what happens. Each of these emanations is like a gate which opens and lets the light through. The emanations are something which we can understand. We can name them. And they are referred to in the Bible in that sentence, "Open ye the gates of light." These are the gates of light. Now look at these two diagrams. I have taken the liberty of using this diagram, which is the conventional diagram, and adding on to that, at the top, instead of having a single circle here under the words Kether Elyon, I have made it a triangle. And the reason is this. This diagrammatic presentation has two forms. This is presented as the tree of life, and this is presented as a man. Man himself, a man as he is here and now. And the Kabbalah uses both symbolisms, presented as a tree of life, and presented as a man. And since it is presented as a man, I have chosen to make this upper triangle, the transcendent triangle, the face and the two eyes. That's what the three circles represent. The head, I should say, and the two eyes. You see? Now, let us look for a moment at this tree of life with all the attributes marked: intelligence, wisdom, judgment, mercy, and so on. They are called also the mystical crowns of God. The first emanation out of the supreme crown is called Chokhmah or wisdom. And the second is on the left side, intelligence or Bina. Chokhmah is a male principle, and Bina is a feminine principle. But there is a curious element here. This feminine principle contains within itself, in latency, both the positive and negative energies. Chokhmah, wisdom, which is associated with the word Abba, father, by sheer presence stimulates Bina. And the positive and negative within Bina interact, and the universe comes into being. You see the ultimate origin of the Immaculate Conception idea. In the Sankhya philosophy in India, we have exactly the same teaching. We have the male principle in Purusha, and the feminine principle in Prakruti, primordial matter. Purusha fecundates Prakruti by sheer presence, just as Chokhmah by sheer presence fecundates Bina. And out of Prakruti, which contains both the positive and negative elements, the entire universe comes into being. There is no concupiscence involved. There is no desire involved. It is an action of a nature which is acausal. This is one of the original meanings of karma. Creative action, karma, creative action is acausal. Thus it is beyond time and space, and the whole idea of consequence, of reward, punishment, of things working out in a future and so forth, don't exist at all in that realm. Good and evil don't exist. And you have the similar teaching in the Kabbalah too. Now consider the significance of this for us. As the Bible puts it, man created in the image of God. This primordial man, known as Adam Kadmon, created in the image of God, is represented by the Sephiroth. And insofar as we ourselves understand ourselves, in the full understanding of ourselves, we touch the final point of manifestation of God, which is in the Shekhinah, or Malkuth, or the kingdom, the glory of God, right down at the bottom. This is our point of contact with transcendence when we have understanding of ourselves. Ein Sof, God as Ein Sof, the infinite, the unknown, is always referred to as He. In the Kabbalah, God as developing through the emanations, making the dark unknown manifest as the lighted up known in terms of the divine attributes as such, is referred to as you. And when this process of manifestation is complete and has reached its full expression, complete individuation, so to say, God says to himself, I. The word I comes in, I am. And it's interesting how in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad you find it stated, in the beginning all this was Atma. Looking around and seeing no other than himself, he said, I am. Now, when we understand ourselves, we are ready to touch this point, the Shekhinah, the glory of God. And through that, work upwards into the you and the he, the ultimate he, the nothingness, the void. It's rather difficult, but try and follow it. Don't be worried if it doesn't make sense. The sense will appear gradually. Now, man uses these terms, intelligence, judgment, majesty, wisdom, mercy, lasting endurance, and Tiferet, which is in the center, compassion, beauty, justice, love, and so forth. They are all involved there, in that central sephira, the sixth sephira. Now, this is represented as the tree of life considered cosmically. It is represented also as man considered humanly. And that which is at the transcendent and the total level is embodied in man at the individual level. You see, in some way or other, Eckhart must have known of these things. The secrets of the Kabbalah were not totally unknown to the Christian world. You remember I quoted one of his statements, his absolutely unequivocal statement, "For man verily is God, and God verily is man." So, the presentation of the teaching with respect to God and the nature of God is really a teaching which tells us just precisely what our potentiality is. Bear in mind how all the theistic religions state that God in himself, in his absolute nature, is unknown and unknowable by man. All right, then how did they start talking about all these things? Simply because human beings, the few, through self-discipline, freed themselves from the misconceptions of the nature of the self, realized what it meant to live and function as beings whose minds were completely purified and thereby enlightened. And they perceived with unerring insight, with pure insight, that that which was their essential and pure nature was identical with the essential and pure nature of the totality, of the absolute, of the whole. of the unborn, the unbecome, the unmade. You can use any terminology you like, Buddhist or Hindu or Judaic or Christian or any, and you will find that in these fundamental things, right at root, they have one identical teaching. The formulations are not identical, but the underlying reality is the underlying reality. We have different words in the language to represent any one thing. The fact of any one thing, hunger or thirst or anything which is universal, a table or a chair or whatever it is. We have different words and we have different ways of describing the one thing. But the thing is the one thing, whatever it is. So now this presentation in the Kabbalah and through the instrumentality of the Kabbalah is one of the supreme representations of the self in its transcendental reality and as embodied in man. But perhaps the Kabbalistic presentation is one which so intensely represents the self that human beings tend to start with the misconception, easily start with the misconception of the self as being something everlastingly separate, a separate identity. Do you get that? The selfness, the element of selfness, tends to get overemphasized in the one who hasn't understood the Kabbalistic presentation. That is why the Kabbalah took the trouble to make clear that in the presentation of God in this manner, He is they, all the different Sephiroth, and they are Him. It's one great union, state of union. That easily gets missed out when we think of ourselves in these terms. And the separate selfness gets emphasized. It is one of the root causes of the extreme individualism of those peoples, the different peoples over the world, who have been influenced by this teaching. And the Kabbalah is the root of the whole of the Judeo-Christian culture. See, the emphasis upon the development from Ein. Ein means the no thing. The word for nothing or no thing in Hebrew is Ein. And the Ein Sof ultimately develops and manifests as the Shekhinah, the glory in which God says to Himself, I. And you see, Ein and the Hebrew word Ani, which means I, have the same letters of the alphabet interchanged. So ordinary people hold on to the ani, the I, and forget that the separately, the isolatively self-conscious I is only the no-thing, the aim reversed. I am nothing. I am the no-thing. The no-thing is me. Here, O Sariputta, emptiness is form, and form is emptiness, as in the Mahayana. You see now how very differently the underlying truth is expressed in the, shall we just roughly for convenience call it the Western tradition, the Kabbalah and the Judeo-Christian development, and the Eastern tradition, finding its culmination in the Mahayanic presentation. But it's the identical thing. When we human beings see or understand, we understand only very partially. And we tend to emphasize one at the expense of the other aspect. We can't see the wholeness wholly all the time. In those extraordinary flashes that come to us when we are suddenly quiet and we have ceased to see with our eyes, as such, we have ceased to see, then the seeing which is knowing by being takes place, and then we are unrestricted in the seeing, the understanding, the knowing. So long as the seeing, the understanding is the result of and subject to the limitations imposed by a sense activity, in this case the sense of sight, we will always see partially. But when it is unrestricted by the sense of sight, and this seeing which is a knowing by being takes place, then the wholeness is suddenly there. And the irreconcilability of the two sides, the mystery of the koan, is just perfectly clear. When we come back to the use of speech and words and thoughts, we are again in difficulties. So you see, here is a way of understanding the self by trying to understand the nature of transcendence, which is embodied in man. And therefore self-discipline consists in a learning of the nature of the transcendent self, which is that towards which the individual self is growing. We'll stop there now.